Oh, such a clutch off-season pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Shop Blinds.com right now and get up to 45% off select styles and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Save up to 45% at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's one thing that will forever change the way you sleep, and it's the softest, 100% organic cotton bedding from Bull & Branch. You'll fall asleep faster, wrapped in the most luxurious comfort. You'll never sleep hot again with airy blankets, cloud-like duvets, and breathable sheets. You'll experience pure comfort on night one and feel your bedding get softer with every wash. Discover the difference with 15% off your first order at bullandbranch.com with code ODYSSEY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
College holds a mythic place in American culture, but there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Pardon me. All right. Welcome. It is Bowerly on News Radio 930 WBEN. WBEN Arthur Pressman, Traffic Attorney. News Time is coming up on 211. And joining us on the Trocare College WBEN live line, we have a guy who is from Buffalo, who began his career as an air traffic controller in the 1980s and was the supervisor of Miami air traffic control. So anything you've always wanted to know about air traffic control but never had the opportunity to ask, we will open up our telephone lines for you. 803-0930. That's in the 716. 803-0930, star 930 on the cell phone, 1-800-616-WBEN. And we welcome aboard Brian Foley. Brian, thanks very much for joining us. Much appreciated.
Tom, my pleasure. Thanks.
So tell us the story about how you became an air traffic controller.
Well, it's kind of a comical story, actually. I was living at home, working a job that didn't pay very well. And Ronald Reagan fired 16,000 air traffic controllers. My father, who was an attorney at the time, Paul Foley, came home, got sick of me living in the house with an application for the federal government completely filled out. And he says, sign this, you're going to be an air traffic controller. I signed it, he mailed it in, and long story short, I had to pass an assessment, it's a civil service exam assessment, had to pass that. Once that happens, I went to Oklahoma for a screen where 60% of the people that went there failed. After the three-month screen, I went to Miami, my duty station, and I had to certify. It took 2 years to certify, and during the certification process, we lost another 50%. Of our employees. So to say the least, it's the most pressure packed time of my career was actually getting hired. And it's a long time.
I want to go back to like what kind of things they asked of you in the assessment. What were the metrics?
Basically they're doing a lot of mathematical problems, and they want you to give a response and answer the questions rapidly. So you have a multiple choice scenario where you have to get through all the 100 questions in a very short period of time. And a lot of them are mathematics, simple mathematics, decision making. It's basically an aptitude assessment to see if you have the capability of possibly becoming an air traffic controller.
And the screening process, in what ways is that different?
What we do there in Oklahoma is you actually run air traffic control problems in a non-radar environment. This would be using rules to separate airplanes using roads in the sky and without anything to visually see them. You have to have a mental picture in your head of where these airplanes are on these roads. And you had to memorize the map road, which took a couple weeks to memorize. And again, they make you separate aircraft using non-radar rules.
And you are one of only 40% of the people entering the screening program to successfully pass.
Correct.
And then you go into the certification itself, which is, I would imagine that is something like a two-year apprenticeship. Is that in the ballpark?
Yes, it is. What you'd be doing, Tom, is you work with a certified air traffic controller who would be your trainer. And you would then be working with live aircraft under the guidance of your trainer. And when I was hired, it took about 2 years to certify completely. It takes longer now. It's just the program just takes a longer time now. But back when I did it, it took 2 years before you were completely certified and allowed to work on your own.
Just to get a better handle on the kinds of people who are responsible for our safety in the sky, other than the flight crew, were you always somebody who had an interest and an aptitude for mathematics?
Yes. Basically, my history and my spelling in high school was horrible, and I loved math, and I was very good at math.
So that was the key requisite skill for which they were looking. And how difficult was it for you, given the high dropout rate, the high knockout rate? How difficult was it to translate your intellectual interest in math toward the practical application of it as an air traffic controller?
I think it comes pretty much naturally, Tom. You know, when you're separating the aircraft and using the rules that you're given, there is a lot of math involved. Speeds, you know, this aircraft flying 400 miles an hour, this aircraft flying 500 miles an hour. You have to look at it and say, do I have time to climb this aircraft above this aircraft, given the fact that their closure rate is 750 miles an hour and I only have 2.5 minutes to get them above a certain altitude? These are the kind of things that that go through your mind constantly and rapidly. And I just think being good at mathematics helps you make those decisions.
Brian Foley is with us, former air traffic controller. He was supervisor of the Miami airport, and he is a Buffalo guy, and he's joining us on News Radio 930 WBEN. And if you have any questions for a real, live, retired air traffic controller, be sure to give us a buzz on the Trocare College WBEN live line at 803-0930, star 930 on the cell phone, 1-800-616-WBEN. WBEN Arthur Pressman, traffic attorney. News time is now 2:17. So the two-year apprenticeship during that time when you were earning your certification to be an air traffic controller, can you tell us about any experiences you might have had that would have been close calls had you not been under the direct supervision of somebody who was certified?
Well, I'd like to say I was pretty good and I didn't have that many, to be honest, Tom, but because I was in an apprentice situation, there were times where I would make mistakes and the airplanes would start to get a little bit too close. And that is the purpose of your trainer. At that time, they would tell you to stop talking and they would take over the frequency, figure out the problem I just started, and separate the aircraft until the situation gets under control, and then give the frequency back to me to continue training.
Now, earlier you spoke about having to work things out in your head during the screening process. The equipment with which you were working, how did that integrate with the stuff in your head?
Well, what we did in the screening process out in Oklahoma, they give you a strip, basically a piece of paper with the aircraft call sign on it, say it's American 110, the type aircraft it is, his speed, and his route of flight. And we'd have, say, a dozen to 15 of these pieces of paper with different aircraft on them and different routes of flight, and they're all conflicting with each other. And we have to figure out how to get them all at altitudes and or routes to keep them separated. And you have to have this picture in your head mentally of these roads and where these airplanes are on the roads.
So having had it in your head during the first part of the training process, how much more confident do you feel once you've actually got the gear in front of you?
Oh, much more. In fact, when I came to Miami, I worked both at the Miami airport and also at the center. It's called the center. It's a larger building where we actually use non-radar rules in the ocean. We controlled airplanes over the Atlantic Ocean down through the Bahamas, close to Haiti, Santo Domingo, and we used non-radar rules back in the 80s before we had radar sites in those places. So it was great to use it. I had the experience and the training initially, so transferring that to live aircraft wasn't that difficult.
When did you walk away? What year did you retire?
2013.
So, obviously,
31 years. Yeah, excuse me.
Over a decade of experience. Since your retirement, have you kept up on advances in technology that have taken place both within air traffic control as well as the aircraft themselves?
No, not really, Tom. Once I left the building, I stopped being obviously trained and getting information on the new equipment that comes in. And so I'm really not up to par on their current equipment they use, but it's pretty similar to what they were using when I was there in 2013. It's not that much different.
Has the in-flight collision avoidance equipment come considerably further now than it was when you stepped away in 2013?
I'm sure it has. It was used a lot, and it was very common when I retired. All the aircraft had it. The commercial airliners had it. A lot of the smaller private aircraft did not, but all the commercial planes did have the TCAS avoidance system. And yes, it was very common, and I'm sure as all technology it improves year to year as they make upgrades.
Now, this question is rather self-evident, but I'd like you to explain a little bit. What is it like on an everyday basis? See, if I come to work and I screw up, nobody dies. I don't have the responsibility of anybody's lives on my hands. If you go into work, what is it like having that kind of responsibility of tens of thousands of people you literally have to keep alive in the air? That you've got to live with that. Can you discuss the stressors that places on you?
Well, it's, like you say, every job's got stress. There's just different levels of stress. And as an air traffic controller, we're not allowed to make a mistake. And unfortunately, sometimes we do. And sometimes airplanes get too close. You are monitored by management. If you make a mistake, there's going to be paperwork involved. If you make too many mistakes, your certification will be pulled, and you'll be required to go through remedial training and then a recertification, which you'll be required to successfully fulfill. And if you can't, you'll be terminated. But the pressure of making mistakes is always there. I like to think that most of us were adrenaline junkies, and we just love the competition and the challenge of sitting in front of a radar scope with 30 airplanes and just making it work. And you just, you feel good when you're done. And I think most of us look at it that way. We don't look at the fact that, oh, that's American. He's got 300 airplanes. Okay, that's a twin Cessna. He's only got four. We don't look at it like that. There are blips on a screen. It's a video. It's a video game with real lives, but we just look at it as a challenge, and I think that's the easiest way to describe it.
It sounds to me almost like, in order to avoid insurmountable stress, you almost have to detach yourself from the reality of human lives and view it, as you just said, like a video game.
Correct. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Until, you know, something bad happens when one aircraft says, listen, I saw the blue eyes of that pilot when he went by me. What's going on down there? You know, things... That's when all of a sudden you take a seat back and say, what? Where'd he come from? I didn't see that guy. And that happens because there's planes out there flying that are under visual rules and that we don't talk to. And they are required to maintain their own separation. And sometimes they get too close to other airplanes.
And we talked about this yesterday, but, you know, we got into a little bit the advantages and disadvantages of the various wing configurations, the high wing versus the low wings, and the various visibility constraints that puts on each aircraft.
Well, yeah, true. But, you know, the cockpit is pretty wide open. They have, you know, I've ridden in the cockpit many times, and they have a big window up there, so they can see pretty much everything.
We're talking with Brian Foley, who is a retired air traffic controller. He comes from Buffalo. His father brought him home an application because he was a cellar dweller in the 1980s, but Brian always had an aptitude for math and ended up becoming a longtime air traffic controller and was actually in charge of air traffic control in Miami. So if you have any questions, as Brian is with us on the Trocare College WBEN live line, you can certainly call at 803-0930, star 930, 1-800-616-WBEN. WBEN Arthur Pressman Traffic Attorney News Time is coming up on 236 rather, as we speak. We're going to continue talking with Brian about his career, some of the incidents for which air traffic control is trained. And we've alluded to mistakes. And in addition to separation mistakes, what kind of other mistakes do you have to look out for if you are an air traffic control person? Find this actually quite fascinating. 803-0930, star 930, 1-800-616-WBEN. It is Bauerland News Radio 930 WBEN. Our guest is Buffalo-born and raised Brian Foley. Over 30 years as an air traffic controller, including the supervisor in Miami. And anything you've always wanted to ask somebody who has done that for a living but never had the chance, well, this is your chance on the Trocare College WBEN live line at 803-0930, star 930, 1-800-616-WBEN. I want to take your calls shortly. I just have one question that I want to get in for Brian Foley. Brian, in addition to maintaining separation between aircraft to avoid mid-air collisions, as we saw the other night, what are some of the other responsibilities that you would have as an air traffic controller?
Well, that's the big one, obviously, Tom. And in addition to that, we would be assisting the airlines and the private pilots filing their flight plans if they're confused on which routes they should be filing, because we have one-way routes sometimes up in the sky. We would assist them in doing that. We would be coordinating constantly with a meteorologist that was on site to keep updated with the weather and the thunderstorm activity, which we have a lot in South Florida. Those are the main things, just assisting aircraft companies, private pilots, and that's away from the radar scope and away from talking to the airplanes. when we're talking to the airplanes, it's basically safety and separation. That's pretty much it. We coordinate, for example, at Miami Tower, we'd be coordinating with some of the smaller airports around Fort Lauderdale Executive, Pompano, Tamiami. We coordinate with them as to how much traffic they're going to have in the near future departing, so we can integrate their traffic with our traffic, things like that.
Well, I've got a million questions, but I know people want to talk to you, Brian. 803-0930, star 930, 1-800-616-WBEN. Let's go to Zach in North Tonawanda. Zach, you are on WBEN with retired air traffic controller and the supervisor of Miami, born in Buffalo, Brian Foley. And Zach, you're on WBEN. Hello.
Hi, Brian and Tom. So yesterday I briefly heard somebody speak about a lockdown procedure when there is an incident in air traffic control. I was wondering if you could speak to the differences between how a minor incident and a major incident is handled, how data is preserved, if people are actually physically locked in a room and not allowed to leave, and how that works usually and how it resolves itself. Other than that, I just took that hang up and listened. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Brian.
Okay, well, I think he's talking about when the controllers are involved in an incident, they're not allowed to leave. I think he was getting reference to the accident yesterday. What happens is when there is a crash, whether it's a fatality or non-fatality, or even an incident where airplanes get too close, the controllers will be drug tested, and they have to stay in a room until the testing facility gets there to do a drug test and also an alcohol test. This is mandatory basically to for possible litigation down the line, and it's just protocol. As far as a small situation or a large situation, a lot of times that's up to the supervisor. If the airplanes would have to get pretty close, or there would have to be a crash to implement the drug testing. I hope I answered what he was talking about.
And how about the preservation of the data? Are there procedures in place to make sure that nothing gets written over or erased accidentally?
Yeah, so we keep all voice tapes for a couple weeks. There'll be nothing erased for at least 2 weeks. And in a situation like this where there's an incident, well, those tapes are kept until the investigation is concluded. But just everyday activity, the voice tapes are kept for a couple weeks.
You know, obviously, pilots are under regulation as to how much they can drink prior to a flight and how many hours they've got to be sober. They're well aware of that. Well, what is the deal with air traffic controllers?
Well, we get random drug and alcohol testing. The used to be you couldn't have a drink for 8 hours before your shift. That was before they implemented the random alcohol testing. Once they did that, I mean, it's up to you to be responsible enough to do your job, and you're subject to random testing at any time. You know, personally, I thought I did my best vectoring with a hangover, but you know, that's a story for another day. But that was a long time ago.
Brian Foley is with us on News Radio 930 WBEN. Let's go to Mark in Amherst. Mark, you're on with Brian Foley. Hello.
Tom and Brian, thank you very much. Great show. Two quick questions. One, I fly every week for work. I was coming in about 2 weeks ago on a flight heading into Buffalo when we were approaching the runway. And the flight was ready. The plane was ready to land. We were about probably 200 yards from the runway. And then the pilot, we didn't touch down. The pilot hit the gas and we went back up. Is that caused by another plane being on the runway, or what causes a situation like that?
Well, usually, yes, that is the case. Now, it could be a situation where the plane was cleared for takeoff, was advised that you're on what's called a short final, and cleared for a takeoff, and the aircraft couldn't quite get everything done, their checklist done in the cockpit, or for some reason they couldn't accelerate off the runway in a timely manner, and it just wasn't going to be a safe situation. So for safety purposes, your aircraft that was on approach is told to go around, and you just make a loop around and land.
Second question is, how many years that you've been doing what you've been doing, have you ever seen anything on your screen that represented a UFO or something you couldn't identify?
Well, that's a great question. You know, back in the 80s, the late 80s, UFOs were very, very popular. And I did say I worked at the control center that controls aircraft all over, 200 miles off the east coast of Florida. We're controlling airplanes going north and south in the channel we call the channel. And one night I was working, and I had multiple aircraft report traffic. And I had a one Delta airplane says, "Miami, we had traffic go right by us at our altitude. Who's out there?" And I told him, I said, "There's not an aircraft within 100 miles of you right now." And I had two other aircraft report seeing a bright light and traffic very close to them. I'm showing nothing on my radar scope, absolutely nothing. And so protocol, I advised the pilots. I said, "Would anybody like to file a UFO report?" And, of course, there's silence on the other end because they don't want to do that, and everybody will think they're cuckoo. Maybe lose their pilot's license, but nobody formally would ever report it. But I had multiple, and that's not the only time, multiple reports of traffic being seen, bright lights, fast moving, and our radars are showing nothing.
Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate the call. And that's not the first time, Brian, that I've heard that pilots absolutely, even now, will not file a UFO report because their sanity is going to be called into question and they might lose their livelihood.
That's correct.
Yep. Wow. Let's go to Howie in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. You are on with Brian Foley, longtime air traffic controller, over 30 years in the field, supervisor in Miami, born and raised in Buffalo. Howie, you're on WBEN. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? First-time caller. I'm going to try to articulate some information. I've been doing a lot of watching on the computer, YouTube. There was a pilot who said, who had actual recording of the air traffic control conversation. And we hear about IFR and VFR. And what how he interpreted it was that the air traffic controller had given over VFR to the helicopter. And we did hear something in one of the tapes that said, "Do you see that plane?" And then next thing you knew, there was a collision. But apparently he thinks it was the control or the responsibility was given over to the helicopter pilot, and the helicopter pilot said, "Yes, I see him," but he saw the wrong plane. Whether it was that one that was taking off that you see in the videos, but he had his eye on the wrong plane and never identified the one that was the closest to him. And the next thing you knew, there was a collision. So I think it was twice that he actually said, "Yep, I've got him." So, you know, the air traffic controller probably didn't see any evasive action or, you know, motion steering the helicopter away. And he said, "Are you sure you see him?" And then the collision. So this VFR, I think once that happens, then the air traffic controller is merely like a backup, like saying, "You're not doing what you're supposed to do. You better, did you really hear what I said to you?" And we talked about helicopters.
Howie, no, that's very interesting. I want to get Brian's take on it. Brian, I'm sure you've had a chance to listen to the tapes and to watch the video and may have formed some preliminary analyses of the situation. What's your take?
Well, you're kind of right and kind of wrong. What happens is we are responsible as controllers to separate IFR airplanes, instrument flight rule aircraft. In addition, a VFR aircraft, the helicopter, if we are talking to him and have him radar identified, we are also responsible to issue traffic to that aircraft and or helicopter. Now, the voice tape, from what I understand, we have a language. It's called phraseology. And from what I understand and what I heard, the phraseology the controller used to issue the traffic to the helicopter, let's just say, wasn't the best. It was a little confusing. We're supposed to give, you have traffic at 1 o'clock and 2 miles opposite direction in RJ, regional jet. And the controller did not give a clock compass position and or a mileage. And from there was an RJ departing, and it looked like the helicopter saw the departing aircraft and not the one on final approach course. So there was that's a confusing situation there. But once the controller hears the helicopter say, we got him, okay, he doesn't have to worry about those two planes being too close or having an issue because he sees the traffic. And being under visual rules, he's responsible to separate himself from that aircraft. And in this case, obviously he didn't, but there could be some phraseology issues involved with that.
Are you saying that the controller should have been more direction, altitude, and speed specific in his conversations with the Black Hawk pilot?
Yeah, speed doesn't matter, but when you issue traffic to an aircraft, you're supposed to give a compass position. Traffic, 2 o'clock. So he would look at 2 o'clock, like on a compass or on a clock. He would look at 2 o'clock and a mileage, 3 miles, opposite direction. So he knows exactly where to look for the traffic. In this case, I did not hear the controller say the compass position or the mileage, just the RJ.
Howie, anything else from you?
No, that's right. I didn't hear that either. And there wasn't very good repeat back either. You know, I'm in the nuclear industry. When someone gives you direction, you repeat back. So you make sure you heard what they intended to say. There wasn't a lot of that. And it was very, like, nonchalant. It wasn't like commands, like military. You know what I'm saying? So it was like, yeah, but there was no 1 o'clock over your, you know, left side, starboard,
okay, we got
whatever,
you.
Below.
Howie, thank you very much. We understand the point. Yep. Brian, go ahead. You were going to speak.
Yeah, I think part of the problem you didn't hear the helicopter was he's on a military frequency, which is called UHF instead of a VHF frequency that the airliners use. So the controller's talking to both aircraft on both frequencies, but the helicopter can't hear what the jet's saying, and the jet can't hear what the helicopter is saying.
And it's always been that way?
Oh, yes, always been that way. I mean, sometimes the military aircraft will speak on VHF frequency, but a lot of times, like this aircraft was on UHF frequency, which is their military frequency.
Brian, there have been some reports that a supervisor at Reagan National believed that the traffic was not going to be particularly heavy the other night and therefore assigned one controller to a position that is usually taken by two controllers. Would that be within the realm of possibility?
Very common, and it's normal procedure. We staff the facilities to traffic. For example, from midnight to 6 a.m., there's hardly any traffic, so you're going to have a very limited amount of controllers working. From 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., during your peak time, you're going to have maximum staffing in your building. And we staff to the traffic. Obviously, Reagan, when it gets to be after 8, 9 o'clock or so, their traffic is reduced, so they go ahead and they They don't pay people to be there to do nothing, basically. You staff to your traffic. It's very common. And in the tower, there's three positions in the tower. There's what's called a flight data position, which basically gives clearances to the aircraft on the ground. American Airlines, you're cleared to Boston as filed. Ground control on this frequency. That's what they do. The second position would be ground control, which moves the aircraft along the ground through the taxiways to the runway and off the runway to the taxiways and to the gate. And the third position is the local controller, which was the voice tape you hear of the guy talking to the planes that are in the sky. That's the three positions. Now, when they close a position, they're closing it because you don't need three people to do the job. It's not that busy. And two people or one person could handle all three jobs, or two people could handle the three jobs. It's standard procedure.
And the importance of moving airliners around on a runway, very much illustrated in Tenerife. I think it was the biggest single loss of life in any crash, and it happened on the ground when two airliners collided way back when. Let's go to Nick on a cell phone on WBEN with Brian Foley, retired air traffic controller, supervisor of Miami, and he's from Buffalo. Go ahead, Nick.
I thought I heard you say earlier that some planes are not in the air traffic controller system and they're kind of on their own. If that's true, why would they allow that?
That's called the visual flight rules. For example, your local dentist who owns a single engine Cessna and goes out on the weekend and flies around Batavia or whatever, just having fun with his wife. He's not under any rules other than the rules of he's not allowed to get within certain amount of miles from an airport. He's on his own, and he's responsible to separate himself from all other aircraft. He's not under any rules of air traffic control or the federal government. If he wants to, he can call the air traffic facility and try to get what's called flight following, where we would identify him, radar contact him, and then issue traffic advisories to him. And that is all workload subject to our workload, how busy we are. If we have time to do that, it's an extra job we would do.
Thank you very much, Nick. I appreciate the call. Coming up on 2:55 at News Radio 930 WBEN, Brian Foley, kind enough to join us. You're sticking around, right, Brian? Because a lot of people want to talk to you. Yeah,
I don't
Brian
have any
Foley.
Business meetings.
Yeah, no business meetings in retirement. And I also want to, as we come back after the news at 3 on WBEN, talk to you about the whole stress factor and the idea that based on what you did for a living for over 30 years that you subjected yourself to a higher probability of an early grave. If that is something that's common knowledge among air traffic controllers, if that's even true. Our phone number, if you have any questions for Brian, former air traffic controller, supervisor in Miami from Buffalo, became an air traffic controller after President Reagan fired the air traffic controllers back in the early 1980s, 803-0930, *930, 1-800-616-WBEN. Brian Foley is with us on the Trocare College WBEN live line. And WBEN Arthur Pressman Traffic Attorney News Time is 2:59. All right, 9 minutes after 3 at News Radio 930 WBEN. It is Bowerly. Our guest is a guy from Buffalo who spent over 30 years as an air traffic controller. The screening and training process is very, very arduous. Was supervisor, air traffic control, Miami. His name is Brian Foley. And if you have a question about the events the other night and how that possibly could have happened, or the route of an air traffic controller in general, the Trocare College WBEN live line phone number is 803-0930, *930, and 1-800-616-WBEN. And again, just to repeat, the reports in several news outlets about, well, you had one controller doing the job of two controllers, that actually is standard operating procedure based on the amount of anticipated traffic at an airport, Brian. True?
That is absolutely 100% true.
Okay, so that's not like some federal spending freeze or whatever resulted in that. It's been going on this way forever.
Yes, it's every facility is staffed to traffic based on the traffic numbers, how many aircraft come through the facility, at what time of the day. And, of course, there's always talk about the controllers are short-staffed, and that's true. There is a staffing shortage right now, but as far as staffing a facility, they are staffed to the amount of traffic, whether controllers have to work overtime to fill the staffing needs or not.
And, you know, you're the second person intimately connected with aviation with whom I've spoken in 2 days, whose initial take has been that the helicopter pilot did have eyes on a plane, just the wrong plane.
Correct. That's based on what's available to the public, since I'm not working, I'm not privy to any inside information, but I know I've listened and seen what everybody else has seen, and from what I understand, that's correct. I will say, though, the strange thing about yesterday's incident is aircraft are not supposed to cross a final approach course of any airport. Now, being this a military helicopter on a training route, he would be exempt of that, but would also be required to be at certain altitudes to keep him safe from the arrivals of the aircraft to the airport. He would be vertically separated based on the altitude he's required to be at. And my understanding is he was not.
And what are some possible most likely causes of that?
Pilot error would be the only cause that I know of. He would be the only traffic that would be allowed to cross that final approach course. All other traffic would be vectored away from there. But because it's a military training route in the Washington area, I guess he's allowed to do that. And from what I understand, they do that on a regular basis.
Yeah, and, you know, listening to the reports yesterday after the crash the night before, that's something that keeps on going through my mind. Is it really necessary to have these military flights going through the final approach routes of civilian aircraft? Couldn't they take another way?
Well, you know, that's above my pay grade, but, you know, that's up to the military and the FAA. And possibly have something to do with the Pentagon, because I think this training route has something to do with the president and political side of, as far as some kind of way to get the president out of the White House. I'm just guessing. That's a guess on my part. But for example, these aircraft crossing a final approach course to an airport. Here in Miami, we have the local police department that fly their helicopter all around downtown Miami, which is where the airport sits. But we transitioned the helicopters, the police helicopters, right over the top of the airport. There's no aircraft flying over the top of the airport. They're either landing or taking off. And that's just common sense and normal procedure. So I'm sure they do the same thing up there at Washington Reagan. However, in this case, you've got a military training route. And I don't know anything other than what you guys know as far as that goes.
Let's get back to the calls with Brian Foley on News Radio 930 WBEN. He's on the Trocare College WBEN live line. Dave in Florida, you're on WBEN. Hello.
Hi, actually, it's Steve from Florida. And I want to thank Brian and other air traffic controllers for helping keep us safe over the years. And my question is, how do you handle the takeover from one air traffic to another, controller to another, when they have to leave the position for a break or the night to keep the continuity with what's going on in the air?
Okay, interesting question. You want to handle that, Brian?
Sure, yeah. Thanks for calling in, Steve. That's actually an excellent question. Controllers usually will not work over 2 hours on a position based on the amount of concentration required, et cetera. So they'll be relieved within 2 hours. So when a controller comes in to relieve the previous controller, he will plug into the unit, listen to the frequency, get a visual picture of what's going on for a couple minutes. He'll then get a verbal briefing from the controller who's going to be leaving. In other words, this is the weather. This aircraft here is going to be doing a touch and go. This aircraft here is on final approach. This aircraft's doing this. This is doing that. Do you have it? And you always say, do you have it? And then the controller that's replacing him would say, I've got it. The other controller will unplug, go have a cup of coffee, and that's how they transition.
Steve, thank you very much for the call. So it's 2 hours on, and then how long a break do you typically get as an air traffic controller?
Well, it would be anywhere from 15 minutes to probably 45 minutes, depending on staffing numbers and traffic.
How helpful was that to you? I mean, you talk about being an adrenaline junkie, and you almost have to be to do that job to get those breaks. Did you return to your post feeling revivified, refortified, all that stuff?
A lot of times, no. You know, a lot of times, if it's a real busy session, you're returning and you still got the adrenaline going. You know, you're still not relaxed and calmed down from the previous session. And other times, yes, you're fine. You had a cup of coffee. You talked about what the Bills did, you know, yesterday, and you come back to work and you're all relaxed. So it varies.
I thought for sure you'd be talking about Taylor Swift, but that was, you know, back in 2013. Brian Foley is with us, former air traffic controller on the Trocare College WBEN live line. True or false, air traffic controllers sacrifice longevity?
As far as life expectancy?
Yes.
I don't know. I'd like, obviously, Tom, I want to answer no to that question. But they say that the stress of the job and also the rotating shifts that we have to work causes a lot of problems as far as your health. Now, the business facility, you got to excuse my bird in the background. I got an African gray parrot. I'm sorry. The busy facilities are open 24 hours a day. So the controllers are required to work rotating shifts. For example, I go in at 3:00 in the afternoon. I leave at 11 p.m. And sometimes I'd be required to come back at 7 a.m. So I got to leave at 11, calm down, settle down, go to sleep for a few hours, get up, return to the facility, and start controlling traffic again. And everybody's required to do the rotating shifts. And they say that puts a lot more stress on your body and your mind than basically anything. I mean, I don't feel the stress when I'm plugged in talking to 30 airplanes. I love it. It's great. But I know that stress is in my body. I know that is somehow putting stress on me. But I like to think I'm relatively healthy at 67 now. And who knows? I really don't want to read the articles about life expectancy of air traffic controllers, to be honest.
Now, understood. Let's get back to the calls on News Radio 930 WBEN. Brian Foley and his African gray are our guests on News Radio 930 WBEN. He's from Buffalo, longtime air traffic controller, was supervisor in Miami. Tom in Amherst, you're on WBEN. Is there any chance you can move a little further away from your African gray, Brian?
Well, I can try. How about if I go outside?
then it'll be the barking dogs and the sirens, but we'll take what we can get. Tom, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, okay. It's been reported that there was a change in runway on the RJ that was coming in. And looking at the vector analysis of each runway, the runway that they were supposed to run land on and the runway that they were changed to, it appears that by the change of that, it put the RJ on a direct track with the collision point of the helicopter. So if they followed the original landing plan, the plan would have been landing well before the collision point. Can you comment on that as far as the vector analysis and closing speeds and things of that sort?
Well, without being able to look at the radar data in front of me, it's hard to comment. However, changing runways when an aircraft's on final approach is not uncommon. You might have an aircraft that they want to depart the runway he's supposed to land on, so they just move them over. I believe he went from runway 01 to runway 33. And that's very common. I will comment on that. But without looking at the radar data and the track of the helicopter and the track of the aircraft, I really can't tell if that was one of the factors.
It looks like it would have taken more time, and I'm not talking about minutes. I'm talking about like 30 seconds or so to go from the first runway that it was supposed to land on to the change runway that it ultimately was heading for, and that put it right on the direct impact of where the helicopter hit it.
Right.
In other words, what I'm saying is that the RJ would have been landing about 30 seconds sooner on the previous runway that they originally had the plan for. And if that wasn't conveyed to the helicopter, which, you know, the change, then the helicopter wouldn't have made a change and would continue on its original path.
Well, the helicopter is listening to the frequency. He should know what's going on. But again,
a last minute change, you know.
Right. We understand your point, Tom. Thank you very much for the call. Brian, go ahead.
There's a lot of moving parts in that. Again, you know, you have the visual separation issue with the phraseology. You've got the helicopter could be at the wrong altitude. You got the change of runways. There's going to be a lot of moving parts, and that's why it takes so long for them to come up with a final report from the NTSB.
You know, a lot of people want to know why the air traffic controller just wasn't shouting at the helicopter, "You're heading towards a collision. You're heading toward a collision."
Well, he issued the traffic. In his mind, he issued the traffic, and the helicopter says, "I have him." So in his mind, the helicopter is in visual rules. He sees the traffic, and he's going to miss the traffic. So in his mind, he goes on to his next priority.
How familiar are you with Reagan?
I should have went to his funeral because he's my hero.
No, not the former president, but the airport.
Oh, the airport. Okay. I'm not that familiar. I mean, I know they're fairly busy. They're probably the 20th, 25th busiest airport in our nation. They're fairly busy. But as far as the inner workings of the airport itself, I am not familiar.
Let's go to CJ in Buffalo with Brian Foley, former air traffic controller, supervisor of Miami. He's from Buffalo on the Trocar College WBEN live line. Go ahead with your question, CJ.
Hello, Mr. Foley. I got a question.
Okay.
Has the FAA ever recovered from the Reagan administration firing all the air traffic controllers back in 1981? Is there something, in your opinion, that prevents qualified folks from applying for jobs? It seems that they are worth much more than they're paid, considering the importance of the job.
Okay, two questions there. You were there in the post-PATCO strike era. That's actually how you got your job, because there were a lot of openings at one point back in the early 1980s. We're talking about over two generations of workforces. You want to address that?
Sure. What I will say is that, yes, they got after Reagan fired the controllers, they got up to staffing. Well, we were at full staffing for quite a while. Now, what you have to understand is once you get 20 years of air traffic service, you're eligible to retire. So the strike in 1981, in 2001, there was a hell of a lot of air traffic controllers that retired. And the federal government did not hire enough people in a timely manner to get them recertified or get them certified at that time to replace the controllers that are retiring. So now we're in a shortage. 20 years after 01. They're going to have another bunch of air traffic controllers that are retiring. And just the federal government doesn't hire ahead of time, for example. They should be hiring 2 years prior to a group of retirees they know are going to be leaving the buildings. They should be hiring these new controllers to get them certified so the staffing numbers are up to par. Even now, the staffing numbers are down. The controllers are working a lot of overtime, and that's more stress also. And that goes to your money issue. They're making a hell of a lot of money right now, most of these controllers, but they're getting their brains beat in working 6 days a week. So it's a catch-22.
CJ, thanks very much. Appreciate the call. What is the typical salary for an air traffic controller, Brian?
Well, it's all based on how busy your facility is. For example, if you're working in Fayetteville Tower, you're probably making $80,000 a year without the extras, and the extras, I mean, night differential, Sunday pay, overtime, holiday pay. That's all on top of your base pay. You know, the base pay might not look like much when you look at it, but once you add all the extras, it adds up. At Miami, for example, I don't know for sure because it's been a while, but I know there's controllers there right now making over $250,000 a year after their overtime, night differential, and holiday pays. But they're working 6 days a week almost every single week. Their base pay there is probably about $150,000.
And given the responsibilities they have, I don't think anybody's going to begrudge them the money. 326, we're going to continue with Brian Foley from Buffalo, long time, over 30 years air traffic control experience. He was the supervisor in Miami, and he told us the story earlier about how he became an air traffic controller. He was living with his dad, and his dad got sick of that, brought home a completed application to be an FAA air traffic controller, and told his son Brian to sign it. Brian signed it, and the next thing you know, he's an air traffic controller after the screening process, after the assessment process, and after a two-year, well, what essentially amounts to an apprenticeship by under the tutelage of an accredited air traffic controller. It is 227. It's fascinating stuff. Brian is with us on the WBEN Trocare College live line, and your questions at 803-0930, star 930, 1-800-616-WBEN. And welcome. It is Bowerly on News Radio 930 WBEN. We're all aware of what happened the other night in Washington, D.C., and a lot of people don't know a lot about air traffic controllers, what they do, how they train, what their lives are like, and here to set the record straight, Buffalo-born Brian Foley, who is a retired air traffic controller, was supervisor in Miami, and if you have any questions about something you may have heard the other night or in the subsequent hours, or about the life and times of an air traffic controller, Brian Foley is more than happy to stick around and answer those questions for you. We're learning a lot, and we're learning it together. Brian Foley is on the Trocare College WBEN live line at 803-0930, star 930, and 1-800-616-WBEN. He's kindly moved into the Florida sun away from his very vocal African gray parrot, which should live another 100 years. Let's go to Ron in Alden on WBEN. Hello, Ron.
Hello, Tom.
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
I have 14 grandkids, and I was curious as to how much it cost to go through the process till you became an air traffic controller.
Okay. Well, it's different now than when I went through, because when I was hired, obviously, it was pretty much a state of emergency for the nation after Ronald Reagan fired everyone, so the hiring process was a little different. Nowadays, to qualify, the best path is to go to a two-year air traffic control school. There are schools scattered throughout the country. You can Google exactly the locations, et cetera, but it's a two-year school. I do not believe the cost of that school is very high. What they do is they prepare you for the entry-level aptitude assessment test that you have to pass to become a controller. And because you're going to be prepared to take that test, and they hire off of the results of that test, the higher scores are the first ones to get hired. And from that point, you would then go to Oklahoma to the screen that I previously talked about. It's a 3-month screen in Oklahoma. If you pass that, you go to your assigned facility. But that is the best path to become an air traffic controller at this time.
And but before we even get to that point, Brian, we talked about this at the beginning of the show. You really need to have an aptitude in mathematics. If you don't, you're going to be pounding your head up against a wall, right?
Well, it helps. I mean, seeing things in three dimension helps. Yes, mathematics definitely helps. I'm convinced it helped me. But yes, it definitely helps. And the one thing I might add is you cannot apply for an air traffic job after the age of 30. So it's a young person's game.
Ron,
did you have a four-year degree before you started?
A four-year degree. I mean, I don't know if it'll help you because it's such a unique job, taking the aptitude assessment exam that they give you. It might. However, the two-year school definitely prepares you for that, and we've seen the most success of controllers being hired coming out of the schools. But yes, you can just go. It's a civil service exam. You can apply to take the test, and you could try that route. Sure.
So apply through the FAA.
I would go to FAA.gov on their website and research from there.
Okay.
Ron, thank you very much. Of course, I would imagine, Brian, like anything else, it's regardless of what the caller wants, it has to be something in which his grandkids would actually have an interest.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, it's for that level of commitment and dedication, you'd better like what you do for a living, and you did.
I loved it. Yes.
Adrenaline junkie, and it gave you your daily fix.
There you go.
All right. 803-0930 is the phone number. Line open at this point. Star 930 on the cell phone, 1-800-616-WBEN. Let's go to Joe in Blaisdell. You're on with Brian Foldy, longtime air traffic controller, supervisor at Miami. He is retired now. And, Joe, you're on WBEN. Hello.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. My question for Brian, basically, does the controller need to be aware of like the type and size of each aircraft when they're providing clearance, like for landings and departures or takeoffs? You know, I'm thinking from turbulence, you know, like a jumbo jet versus...
Oh, yes. There's different separation standards on, especially like departures, for example. There's certain minutes you have to have between departures. There's different separation standards between a light aircraft and a heavy jet, between a medium jet and a heavy jet. You need to know how many engines each aircraft has in case they say they've lost an engine. Well, is it their only engine, or do they have two? Do they have four? You need to know the characteristics of their speeds, how fast they fly, how fast they climb, how fast they can descend. This all comes into play when you're playing the game.
Definitely. I can see where your math comes into play. Well, thank you very much. That's all I needed. Thanks.
All right, thank you very much, Joe in Blaisdell. Our number again, 803-0930, star 930, 1-800-616-WBEN. What were some of the most common mistakes that you saw as an air traffic controller, in particular among the more inexperienced ones? We talked about, obviously, the priority of keeping aircraft separated in the air. Were there other mistakes that stood out?
Some of the common mistakes would be not being aware of the speed of certain airplanes. For example, you got a twin Cessna. It's a turbo engine twin Cessna that's allowed to fly a little higher than the regular Cessnas. Like, say he's up at 20,000 feet and he's mixing in with jet traffic, but he's only going 240 knots and the jets are going 460 knots. Not assessing the difference in the speed fast enough is a common mistake. Working multiple aircraft and not realizing a route of flight, for example, aircraft A is going to turn. He's going to turn over Miami and go northeastbound, and you think he's going northwestbound. These are just common mistakes that experience will tell you. You know, you get to. I don't know. The experience just gives you so much more as far as remembering routes of flight and speeds and being aware of certain traps, for example.
We've all seen movies and TV shows. What does the air traffic controller screen really look like, and what information is available on them?
Let's see. The movie, I think it was Pushing Tin.
Yeah.
I think it was Pushing Tin, that movie. The scene in the air traffic control room scenes in that movie are very accurate. That's a Billy Bob Thornton movie, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I actually have forgotten who's in that movie. It's been a while.
Yeah. But they actually they had some air traffic controllers they hired to advise them of what the air traffic control room should look like and how you how people act in the control room. But if you watch that movie, and what happens in the control room scenes is pretty close to what really happens in the live environment. Now that's just an overview. Now as far as technically what you're looking at on a radar scope, you're looking at a round radar scope, or it could be a square radar scope, depending how old they are. And you've got a bunch of blips, and associated with the blips is what's called a data block. And the data block will give you information, aircraft call sign, type aircraft, speed, current speed, and destination.
And yes, Billy Bob Thornton was, in fact, the major name in Pushing 10 in 1999. Brian Foley, major name in air traffic control, retired in 2013, is with us on News Radio 930 WBEN. Safe to say that the scenes from Airplane did not realistically depict air traffic control?
Great movie, but no, I can honestly say that doesn't really happen up there. No.
When you watch a movie like Airplane, are you able to laugh, or are you able to say, oh my goodness, that does not happen? This is giving us a bad reputation.
No, I laugh. It's a comedy. Everybody should know it's a comedy. I laugh, you know. I think people that cry or get upset would be police officers watching movies of police shows. I think that would be a little more, to get a little more offensive to them. But the air traffic, the few air traffic movies that are out there, most of them are just comedies. That's not a problem.
What is the relationship like between air traffic controllers and commercial pilots?
Well, that's an interesting question, Tom. I mean, for the most part, it's pretty good. You know, it's pretty good. Now, there's been a lot of times where a pilot will get upset with a controller because he's given him unrealistic restrictions, for example. He wants him to send to a certain altitude at a certain point, and the plane physically can't do it. He'll be frustrated. Or on the other end, a pilot will turn the wrong direction from what he's instructed to do. I've had to talk to many pilots on the ground. I said, when you land, you need to call this phone number. I need to have a conversation with you. If I think that they weren't complying with the air traffic instructions, and it's very critical that they completely comply immediately and without error. I mean, their job is as important as our job to get it done properly and safely. But for the most part, yeah, we're pretty good. Now, I've ridden in the cockpit a few times before 9/11 when we were allowed to. And I've had some flight crews where I could tell they did not like air traffic control, because it was just a little bit chilly up there in the cockpit.
Right.
So, yes, there's like any job, there's people that don't like who they work with, and for the most part, it's pretty good.
As far as the chain of command, you are above the pilot, correct?
Well, let's just say that we always are saying is I'm an air traffic controller. We tell pilots where to go.
Huh.
So, yes.
Well, yes, I've heard conversations on some of the ATC tapes where pilots will be on the radio complaining, you've had us circling for an hour. How frequently does that happen, pilots complaining
in
the middle of the flight?
It happens a lot. Yeah, it happens. And the only time that would be happening is, like, for example, an airport closes. Down here in South Florida, we have afternoon thunderstorms in the summer, and the airport might close for an hour. So aircraft go into holding, and they're in a holding pattern. We advise them, expect your clearance in 45 minutes. Expect your clearance in an hour. But they're going to be in holding. They have an alternate airport. If they get low on fuel, they'll go to their alternate airport, whether it's Nassau, Bahamas, Palm Beach, where have you. But that's just the way it is. And some of them, they get frustrated. You know, they want to get on the ground, and they're frustrated. And they think that maybe another airline is getting preferred treatment over them. That happens. You know, how come American is number one and you vectored me behind him number two? How come I'm not number one? You know, you get that going on all the time. It's just part of the job.
Retired air traffic controller Brian Foley is our guest, over 30 years in the field. Fascinating discussion, I think. And I presume that you were working, or were you working, on the morning of September 11th, 2001?
Well, Tom, luckily for me, although it would have been a great experience, I was catching fish in Cabo San Lucas on that day. And so I was not in the facility. However, it is interesting you brought that up. What happened on that day is they declare Skatana. It is a declaration, basically, that we're at war. And Skatana means that the military, the U.S. military, is taking control of all U.S. airspace. And the air traffic controller's job at that point is to get every single airplane on the ground as fast as they can. They didn't know what was happening. Obviously, it was chaos. So the controllers that were working throughout the nation that day did an unbelievable job and got thousands of airplanes on the ground landed in minutes. And the odd thing for me, being out of the country, I wasn't allowed to return to my country for multiple days, although where I was wasn't a bad place to be stranded. But it's a little odd when your country won't let you return home.
Now, we also had some help on that day from our 51st state, Canada.
Yes, we did. Yeah,
great deal. Exactly. Great deal of help. Well, what kind of stories did you hear in the control tower after September 11, 2001, about what the atmosphere was like and the pressure and stresses put on the people in Miami?
Well, the main stress was we had military F-16s flying all around the perimeter of the U.S. and of course around Florida. We had they're in the air constantly, 24 hours a day. And patrolling our borders. And that alone was a little stressful because all the airlines and all pilots, even the private pilots, were informed that they had to be talking to air traffic control. Under no circumstances can they not be talking to air traffic control when they're flying, which is a change. There was no visual flight rules. The doctors couldn't go out and just cruise around in their Cessnas. You had to be talking to an air traffic controller to be flying. And we had a situation where when I was working in the bigger building outside of the airport, we control all the airplanes just north of Cuba coming from South America landing Miami. And we had an Avianca aircraft coming from South America where the Cuban controllers give them to us. So the Avianca comes over to us, but he's not talking to us. And he won't talk to us. And that's a big no-no. And this is where the English and Spanish language barrier comes into effect also. So he's not talking to us. We advise NORAD immediately that this guy's not talking to us. They scramble the F-16 fighters on this commercial airliner, who I'm sure is full of passengers. And they went up next to the aircraft, each side of them, and obviously scared the dickens out of the guy. Finally, he comes up on our frequency, voice shaking, nervous, and we explained to him that he wasn't talking to us and we need to talk to him. He was probably within 30 seconds of being shot out of the sky, which you talk about news, that would have been a horrible situation. But there's a nuclear plant in Miami. You got downtown Miami. They weren't going to let this aircraft fly into the United States without talking to anybody. And that is probably the most stressful thing that I saw post 9/11.
Wow. That is fascinating. I've got a whole bunch more questions, Brian, if you want to stick around for a little bit longer. Brian Foley is with us, and if you have questions for a guy who spent over 30 years as an air traffic controller in Miami, he's born and raised in Buffalo, I would suggest strongly that you call in at about 5 minutes after 4 o'clock so I can judge your interest. I don't want to keep Brian on longer than you find him interesting. I could talk to him all day. 803-0930, *930, 1-800-616-WBEN. Brian Foley is with us on the Trocare College WBEN Lifeline. All right. It is Bowerly on News Radio 930 WBEN. And in light of the horrific crash the other night outside of Reagan National Airport, we have an air traffic controller retired with us on News Radio 930 WBEN, the Trocare College WBEN live line. His name is Brian Foley. He was born in Buffalo, became an air traffic controller after President Reagan fired the other air traffic controllers, spent over 30 years in that field, and has explained to us the training process and how rigorous it is, and the fact that the odds are really against you making it through all the various stages of training. You have to have a mathematical aptitude in order to do that particular job. The money is really, really good. The stress is really good, but he is an adrenaline junkie, and instead of eating at him, he fed upon the stress of the job. And one of the takeaways from today is some of the reports you're hearing are that, well, the supervisor at Reagan gave one air traffic controller both the helicopter duty and the commercial airliner duty. And as it turns out, that is not unusual. That is actually standard operating procedure because you staff for the expected traffic. And the supervisor made the determination that one controller could handle both modalities, the choppers and the incoming regional jets. Is that a correct assessment, Brian, of or restatement of what you've said?
Everything was correct except for the end, Tom. Like I said, there was three positions in that tower, and the local controller that talks to the aircraft that are in the air, he would be in control of all the aircraft that are in the air, including the helicopters. The other positions would be the controller that moves the airplanes around the ground on the taxiways, and the third controller would give clearances to the aircraft that are looking for their clearance to their destination airports.
But the key point is, in light of media reports, it is not unusual for an air traffic controller to have multiple responsibilities for multiple types of aircraft, correct?
That is correct.
Just want to make sure I've got that absolutely correct. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is you talked about an Avianca flight around September 11th that almost got itself blown out of the air because it wasn't talking to air traffic control. And you mentioned Cuba. Obviously, the United States does not have diplomatic relations with Cuba and has not for quite some time. Is there any sparring over the air? What is the relationship like between the Cuban air traffic control people and the Americans?
Well, it's professional. You know, they speak English. English is the universal language of aviation. So they speak English. And we have to get along. We've got a job to do. I mean, we don't go down there and celebrate holidays with them or anything, but everything's professional and we get along fine. Very, very few issues with Cuba. I know they're different than we are, but as far as air traffic control goes, we're on the same page.
When we are over the middle of the Atlantic going to or from Europe, or over the middle of the Pacific going to or from Hawaii, do you always have eyes on and ears on for every aircraft?
No, that would go back to non-radar rules, where you're flying airways, and we might have a simulator approximating where you are on your airways, and the pilots would be broadcasting through satellite frequencies to give us their position reporting, and we would do the same thing, advising them of altitude changes. But for the most part, no. The radar systems go out about 200 to 300 miles off the mainland. So no, you are not being watched. You are being monitored all the time, and the pilots are required to state their position at various spots so we know where you've progressed, where you're supposed to be, and that you are on course. So that's the way that works.
In other words, if we were flying over the Atlantic and had to make a water landing, how soon would air traffic control know that, uh-oh, something went wrong?
Well, if they would probably broadcast a Mayday call to the satellite, and we would know approximately where their position would be at that point. But they would do a Mayday call. Otherwise, we would not know until their next required position point, which might be 100 miles from there. We wouldn't know that something's wrong until then. But they definitely would make a call to let people know that they're in trouble.
Let's go to Diane in Buffalo on WBEN. You are on with retired air traffic controller Brian Foley. Diane, welcome to the show. Your question.
Oh, thank you. My question is, what happens if the controller that's in charge of the ship has a medical emergency? How is that handled? Is there someone who can instantaneously take over his ship?
Yes, there's... Basically, we have controllers that are there, you know, if something happens, and it's not mainly for a medical emergency on the radar scope, for example, but it's if a controller starts to get a little bit too busy, he's getting a little bit overwhelmed, maybe too many airplanes for his skill level. So we have controllers that are right there that could plug in a system. So now you'd have two controllers helping to get the job done. And primarily that's why we have extra controllers immediately available to plug in and assist. Now, I've had situations where I've had a controller have a panic attack. We had a controller that we thought had a heart attack on the position. And again, we have controllers right there to replace them. And, you know, we call 911 just like anybody else would at any other job. But the job, the planes don't stop flying. We can't stop them. So we have to have somebody available to take over.
No, that's fascinating. Okay. Diane, what an interesting question. Thank you very much.
That was a good one.
Yeah, I like that. In the course of your 31-year career as an air traffic controller, I have to ask you, was it a man's world when you entered, and was it a man's world when you retired in 2013? What was the breakdown in terms of men versus women?
Yes and no. It was a lot of men when I came in after the strike, because we had a lot of military controllers who at that time were mostly men. The military controllers were hired by the FAA to immediately take over and start working airplanes. And the hiring process, it just didn't seem like women were that interested in the job. There was women. I mean, I'm going to guess 15%, I'm guessing, maybe, in the early 80s to mid-80s. And maybe when I retired in 2013, 30%, maybe 35% at the most.
Very interesting. Did they face any particular resistance from the other controllers?
Well, that's the word. I mean, if you talk to the women say, we got to prove ourselves more than you do because you don't think we could do the job, et cetera, et cetera. Well, when I was in management and a supervisor, I was in charge of certifying or terminating developmental trainees based on their performance. And well, I didn't treat them any different. And I know some of the men, some of the old timers back in the mid 80s, the old timers that survived the strike, they were anti-women. You know, that's just the way they were. They were old timers and they didn't think women could do the job. They didn't think they could handle it. But as we progressed through the 90s and into the 2000s, I think that all went away.
You know, you were talking about the idea that you're on for 2 hours and then you get at least a 15-minute break as an air traffic controller. How often does it happen where, like our corrections officers, you're suddenly told, you'll be doing a double today? Does that happen regularly?
No. If you're a controller talking to airplanes as opposed to working in an office, you're not allowed to work more than 10 hours. 10 hours maximum in a 24-hour period.
Yeah, I'm still surprised, though, that there were times you would get off late at night and then have to be back early in the morning. Seems healthy or safe.
Yeah, and again, I shouldn't say in a 24-hour period. You can work 10 hours consecutively maximum, and then you have to have 8 hours off before you can work again. That's the way it works. But, yeah, that definitely contributes to the stress and your health. It's been proven that shift work is not healthy. That's been proven in many studies. It's just the way it was, you know, and you had to work holidays, and that's stressful for your home life. You work holidays, you work nights. As you gain seniority, because the holidays are bid by seniority, once you've been in there a few years, okay, and now you get a Christmas off, you get a Thanksgiving off. But in your early years, you're working those holidays, and it can be stressful on the family.
I can imagine. As you review everything that we think we know from the other night, what are some questions that you, as a longtime air traffic controller, would be asking the people who are working that night?
Well, my biggest question, which I believe I already mentioned, and you kind of agreed with it, was why is there a helicopter on a training route going across the final approach course of a major airport? That's just something that shouldn't be happening, and I don't know the inside policies and procedures of Reagan Airport or the military in that area, but to me, that just seems like a really bad idea.
Yeah, that seems like a preventable error. This is something that should not have happened, and if you've already got a heavily congested aircraft, why would you a heavily congested airport, why would you exacerbate that by having training flights in the landing path? That, to me, does not make sense. It didn't sit well when I first heard it the other night, and my understanding is, in addition to the training flights, a lot of the flights that do that are basically VIP flights for military brass from the Pentagon.
Yes, strange, you know, but I will say, though, on the other end of working my job, where, you know, I've worked when we've had accidents and things, and that poor controller, whether he made a mistake, didn't make a mistake, that's to be determined, but that poor guy is going to live with that for the rest of his life, and from what I know in my job, he probably will never return. He probably will get a medical retirement and never be able to talk to airplanes again. Just he mentally wouldn't be able to handle it. Witnessing such a traumatic event like that, I'm just guessing, because I've seen it happen where planes have crashed, and it wasn't midairs. It's just plane crashes and controllers. It just affects them mentally so much. I can't imagine with two airplanes colliding and you actually can see it. So the poor guy is—he's going to go through a lot.
Did you ever have the experience, in particular, with the general aviation aircraft, of being the last person to speak with a pilot prior to the plane ditching or going down?
Only one time, and it was not a good experience. It was a twin engine aircraft that he lost both of his engines, and he was going down. And the last thing I heard was him scream, and. That was bad. But, you know, in this job, I mentally prepared myself, at least tried to. I don't think you can completely, but I tried to prepare myself that someday I'm going to be talking to an airplane that's going to crash. And that's, you just try to handle it the best you can, and you go on. But that's the only time I actually was working an airplane that went down that I was talking to.
How common were both emergency declarations and the ultimate mayday?
Mayday, not so much. I mean, that's like a last, a final plea. But we emergencies a lot. We have a lot of emergencies, and they're various levels. And a lot of times they're low fuel. Okay, we got low fuel. We can't take any unnecessary delays or vectors. We need to get to the airport. I've got a sick passenger in the back. I need to get to the airport immediately. One of my engines is running rough. I want to land. There's a million different types of emergencies and different levels of emergencies.
Last question. Why do they call you Yogi?
I know where that comes from. Well, back when I was in high school, believe it or not, I'm almost bald right now. But back in high school, maybe that's because of the job. But back in high school, I had a full head of hair, a big afro, and I'm a pretty big dude and pretty burly, hairy chest and everything, and I kind of look like a bear.
All right, there you Yogi, go. Thanks. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate that. Thank you. Very, very educational and informational and much grateful. Thank you.
Tom, my pleasure.
Brian Foley from Buffalo, longtime air traffic controller, was the supervisor of Miami. He's been out of the business since 2013, but very, very interesting and some great questions from you guys as well on News Radio 930 WBEN, where the news is coming up at 4:27.